Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Well, today is not exactly the science forum, but we're talking about science today. It's culinary science. The acts of cooking and eating are often described as art or artful. But what is responsible for certain flavors and textures? Most people don't want to think about the words food and chemical in the same sentence, but chemistry is at work whenever we mix, mash, heat, cool, even masticate. I said masticate. From molecular gastronomy and the spherification of juices to the surface tension of an egg yolk and how to make kale taste like chocolate, culinary science is fascinating stuff. We have an expert here in the studio who will give us a tour. Ted Russin is the director of consulting at the Culinary Institute of America. He is a research chemist, recently taught a massive open online course at Harvard. We'll talk about that. He has a master's in food science and agricultural chemistry. And we're also joined today by Jeff Levine, spokesperson for the Culinary Institute of America. Jeff serving as a handler in case Ted says something he shouldn't, right? You'll be able to refute that.
Exactly.
Okay. And Ted, by the way, our Zach, the engineer, let's turn on Jeff's microphone. So it is on?
Here I am.
No, it's the wrong one. Okay. Hey! And there's some science, too. Jeff's here. Ted's here. Welcome, everybody. Nice to have you guys here.
Well, Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much, Ray.
Number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And you can also comment at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You could comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on Facebook. So WAMC Radio at Facebook. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can even email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But by all means, call 1-800-348-2551. And it's not often, even on the science forum, we get a guest in a lab coat. But Ted, you're in a lab coat today.
I am. It's a pleasure to be here, Ray. Thank you so much for the
nice
opportunity.
Nice to have you here.
I travel with my lab coat any chance I get. You never know. As a scientist, you'll be inspired by nature. You come into contact with absolutely everything in your day-to-day sort of meanderings, and you never know when something may inspire you when you have to collect a sample. So I'm quite enthusiastic about my lab coat.
Well, this is fascinating that, you know, when I think of cooking, you think of James Beard, rotund fellow in a kitchen cooking up stuff. I got a feeling he was not too interested in molecular gastronomy.
Well, you know, as part of my position in the college, I also teach in the culinary science program. Mm-hmm. I teach a class in ingredient functionality, which is essentially a class on trying to explain why things do what they do. I subtitled that class, "What Have You Done For Me Lately?" And it's an exploration of fats, proteins, water, these types of macro constituents in food. And while we have the grand artists that are preparing food and making amazing flavors and delicious experiences, at the foundations of everything that they're doing, there's physics, chemistry, and biology.
But this was instinctive. The greats of times past had an instinctive understanding of this?
I think part of the culinary canon and sort of that almost journeyman approach to and stage approach where you basically did internships and learned under masters was this cumulative collection of knowledge that was passed down from master to student, and that went on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And I think that, for example, how best to fry an egg, how best to make an omelet, how best to make a souffle, there are techniques and standard practices that people do and people are taught. At the college, we teach these standard techniques. And even though you can make it properly and you understand the technique, there still is another story going on there.
So it'll never be strictly by the book, no matter how much scientific knowledge you gain. There will always be that certain something.
Well, I think that there's, you know, we have a lab that we do in one of our classes where we're trying to make meringue and we're trying to play with pH. And pH is essentially a measure of the concentration of acid in a system. Mm-hmm. The lower the pH, the more acidic. The higher, the less acidic.
Right.
So lemon juice is very acidic, so it has a low pH. And milk is not so acidic, so it's got a higher pH.
Mm-hmm.
And often in recipes, you'll see add a bit of lemon juice to your meringue to make it more stable. And we had the students basically take a flat of eggs, collect their egg whites, and measure the pH of those different egg whites. And they ranged. The age of the egg, as the egg ages, the pH changes. So a little bit of lemon juice will make a difference. But what if we knew exactly what the starting point was, and we say we know exactly a pH 5.3, we'll get a perfect pillowy soft texture. Let's make that happen every single time. And I think chefs in this day and age, I think the understanding that they have, the tools that they have at their avail, are allowing them to be that much more precise.
But what about creativity? In other words, I read an interesting article in the lead-in to your appearance in which you had, I don't know if it was you, but students dipped strawberries in liquid nitrogen, dropped them on a surface, and let them crack into odd shapes, and then used the powder for, let's say, ice cream. So can science and chemistry and all the things that we're talking about today lead to new frontiers?
I think that that's fair. So, for example, you bring up liquid nitrogen as a technique or as a tool in the kitchen. Liquid nitrogen was discovered or created or actually demonstrated about 100 years ago. We all know that gases can be, or any compound can be a gas, a liquid, or a solid. So in this case, they pressurized it. They were able to get to very low temperature. The application of that technology to biological systems, whether it's medicinal systems or food systems, sort of took root over the last century. And from an industrial standpoint, liquid nitrogen is available for welding and things like that. So that's very commonplace. Mm-hmm. Its move into the kitchen, I would say over the last 10, 15 years, has allowed for novel applications and novel techniques. So, for example, the idea, that technique is called, we call that cryo-shattering, which is a very, very fancy term for saying freeze it and drop it. But essentially, it allows you, as you had said, these odd shapes. So you'll take something like a strawberry, a banana. These are essentially water. They're probably, 80, 90% water. So it will freeze if you leave it long enough in the liquid nitrogen, and by long enough, maybe a minute. You'll take that out. It's rock solid. It's well below freezing. I work in Celsius because I'm a scientist.
And Canadian.
And Canadian.
Right.
So we're looking at well below 0 degrees Celsius. So minus 20, minus 40 by the time you're finished. You drop that on any kind of hard surface, and it will essentially shatter.
Mm-hmm.
And what that allows the chef to do is to create a texture or to create a shape to materials that you can't necessarily replicate with a knife. And you could even I've seen chefs take pieces of salmon, raw salmon, they'd freeze it, and it essentially denatures the protein. So it, in a way, cooks it or denatures the proteins, changes the texture. But then they drop that piece of salmon, and it shatters into pieces, and they sort of recompose it. So it looks like almost this cubist kind of reinterpretation of what a fish could potentially be. And I think that those kind of techniques, that is new. A standard freezer wouldn't allow us to get down to that cold a temperature. Maybe a freezer used in a laboratory then get down to minus 80. But mm-hmm. kitchens don't have that, and that's very expensive equipment.
Yeah.
But using sort of industrially available techniques like liquid nitrogen, you can create sort of completely unexpected sensory experiences.
The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by Ted Russin, Director of Consulting at the Culinary Institute of America, and an expert in stuff that I never even thought of before
but,
today.
Ray, you like to eat, right?
I love to eat.
Yes, yes, you're a very healthy fella. Yeah, you look very healthy.
Yes, indeed. Prosperous, they might say.
So I often sort of have conversations about when I tell people I'm a food chemist, they say, well, that sounds fascinating. And they don't necessarily connect the fact that what they're eating every day is while it may be made with love, when my mother roasts her chicken, she has this love that she adds to it, which makes it extra delicious. But in terms of the proteins that are present there, they're behaving in a particular manner. And you can explain that. There's water present in that. You can explain that. People often talk about chemicals in food and get very upset. But if I was to stop now, Ray, and give you the technical names for the fatty acids that are found in a first-pressed extra virgin olive oil, you'd be a little alarmed at the chemical names that are there too. But if you just describe the food, this is an olive oil, it's sun-kissed, we freshly sort of press the olives, and it's got the flavors of the earth in it. That's one thing. I can also tell you what chemical compounds are there too. And both of those things, it's almost like looking at a food through two sets of spectacles. You can see both sides there.
Now, this has mushroomed this whole science and this whole focus over the last 20, 30 years. Science also has presented safety standards that continually are increased. How does that affect what you teach at CIA?
Well, that's one of the things that we talk to the students about in the program, and as a practicing scientist, I'll often get into conversations with people that they want the answer, one and only answer. And I'll say to them, science is not an answer. Science is a process. Science is a matter of digging deeper into a problem that we may have thought we solved, But we new techniques, new tools, new approaches, new mathematics is allowing us to see deeper into systems that we felt we understood. And when I look at any kind of food and any kind of recipe or any kind of question that comes up in the kitchen, we may try to answer as best as we can now, but we're constantly moving that goalpost. So in a way, I don't ever give a final answer. And maybe I'm being a little wishy-washy and trying to give myself some
wiggle. Oh, it's all right. We're used to that on this program.
Yeah, that's you know,
fine.
You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
But it'd be a little wishy-washy, but that's what science is. Science is not giving you a conclusive answer, but it is giving you a way. You can always demonstrate the science is working. Does what you say happen? That's what you got to look for.
But food is safer today than it was 50 years ago.
Without questions. I remember it was, I went to a trip to the Lower East Side. In New York, I went to the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, and they had talked about two families that had grown up. One family that had grown up before 1930, and one family that had grown up after 1930. And the family that grew up before pasteurization was invented had 8 children, and only 3 of them survived. Mm. And the family that grew up after 1930 had all 5 children survive. So those types of huge, momentous public health insights has changed the world. And we take pasteurization, for example, we take it for granted. But without it, we wouldn't be able to basically eat very much.
We're joined by Ted Russin of the CIA. We'll take a break here and we'll get back to you. Well, actually, we haven't gotten to them yet, but we will get to the calls coming up right after this on a Food Friday on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Cafe Capriccio. Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain their traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982. On Grant Street in Albany, New York, cafecapriccio.com. Orange County Tourism in the scenic Hudson Valley, featuring spring gardens, wineries, boat cruises, country inns, and a full schedule of upcoming events, orangetourism.org. The Bee's Knees Cafe, Preston Hollow, New York, serving weekend lunch and Sunday brunch, monthly 5-course farmed and forage dinners, and grass-fed cooking classes, heather-ridge-farm.com. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, Rhinebeck and New Paltz, providing professional picture framing, fine art materials for students, professionals, and the public, the Atwater Art Gallery upstairs in Rhinebeck, rhinebeckart.com. And Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community, berkshire.coop.
You've all been very, very patient. I've been chatting here with Ted Russin and Jeff Levine of the CIA, and I haven't taken any calls, and I apologize. Let's go to the phones. David in New Paltz, you're first. Hi, David.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for doing a good job there.
Thanks.
I'm reading this book, Wheat Belly, by William Davis, M.D., and he's saying that the wheat that we're eating today is not the wheat that we our ancestors ate. In fact, it's a short type of a stalk, and the chemistry of the wheat is causing diabetes in people, overweight. It's turning men into producing more estrogen, so they're having, you know, like a wheat belly and overweight. And he's saying that you should cut out wheat from your diet entirely because it's been manipulated to the point where it's no longer healthy for you.
All right, fair enough. David, thank you for that one. Ted, what do you think?
Well, David, thank you for your question. You know, in this day and age, I think that there is, and again, I kind of default back to science and kind of say, well, what do we know? What do we know for certain? And what does the literature tell us? There are people, certainly gluten is an ingredient that has gained a lot of visibility in the last 5 years. Gluten sensitivity, gluten intolerance, things like that. The larger public health questions to kind of say essentially, well, it's because we're eating wheat that leads directly to diabetes. I think those types of sort of leaps are, I wouldn't necessarily say it's impossible, but I would say I would wait to see the literature to see if that has been shown in a large cohort of individuals to see that is that what the science is telling us. That doesn't necessarily negate the fact that, of course, grains and wheats and cereal crops certainly have evolved from sort of Cro-Magnon man. That goes without saying. And that has, for hundreds and hundreds of years, tens of centuries, we've been breeding wheat without using sort of high-tech methods. We were doing that ourselves to create different types of wheats that are good for different types of breads. So when it comes to those larger public health questions, I think one thing that we can look at, when I think of something that contains wheat, I would say I would look at the food as a whole and say, well, how many calories are in this piece of food? If it's a loaf of bread and you sit and eat a loaf of bread, while the gluten may be causing you problems, there's a ton of calories that are coming in with that as well, because wheat is also composed of starch. A considerable fraction of it is starch. So there may be sort of more to it than just the proteins. It could be the caloric density of it, and we have to sort of look at it in a larger scale.
Thank you very much for the call. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Eric in Buffalo. Eric, are you calling in Buffalo?
No, I'm a truck driver. I'm going down the I-90.
Gotcha. Okay, well, I hope your hand's free.
Yes, I am.
All right, you're on the air, my friend. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is a question maybe more for the chef.
Okay, sure.
I have a new favorite signature dish. I make, like, vegetables and chicken and, like, a curry sauce. And I try to thicken it with yogurt, because that's the recipe. But it always seems like it wants to curdle. And I preheat the yogurt, you know, in a double boiler. But then when I whisk it in, it always seems like it's going to break. You know what I mean?
This is Ted. Right. This is in your wheelhouse.
I can certainly. Eric, it's great to see. Be safe on the road there, please. Although I am quite excited about your curry sauce here. And it's actually quite timely, because I was actually, I actually just had a little baby girl. She's 10 weeks old.
Oh, congrats.
And my mother-in-law actually just came to visit us. So she's with us for the week. And she actually made a delicious meal for us. And it was, she had a salsa, a warm salsa, into which she added low-fat yogurt.
Okay.
And then as that was warmed, we saw that the yogurt changed. Its texture did change. So I think that's probably the same problem you're having, Eric. Now, if we think about a yogurt, essentially what a yogurt is, it's a yogurt is a controlled curdling of milk to create a particular texture. So you add bacteria, it drops the pH, it becomes acidic, the milk changes its physical shape, and it creates a soft gel. Cold. That fermentation process is all done at about 40 degrees Celsius, 50, 60 degrees Celsius in that space. When you're taking something like a yogurt, which is inherently acidic, and then you're going to take it and heat it, you're going to curdle the milk full stop. That's going to happen. Now, the question I have for you, Eric, is this a full-fat yogurt, or is this a skim or a 0% fat yogurt?
It's regular full milk yogurt, you know, plain yogurt, not like yogurt.
Okay. So the one thing I would suggest is you're creating the perfect storm to curdle the proteins that are present in your yogurt. So if you can, what I would recommend is create your sauce, sort of bring it off the heat, cool it down, drop it to about 70 degrees C, whatever that is in Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is, but that would be a comfortable temperature, sort of a warm temperature in the mouth. And then preheat. I like how you're tempering your yogurt. That's great as well. And then bring those two things warm together, maybe about a 60 or 70 Celsius. You won't curdle your protein, because the violent heat of close to boiling is the problem. So if you could basically cool both of those things down and bring them together at a cooler temperature, I think you'll be able to create a sauce that's not curdled.
Brilliant.
Right. Well, I do shut the pan off
It's still
five
really hot.
It's still really hot.
Like, you wouldn't be able to put your finger in that sauce, because it's still that hot.
Right.
So you might want to sort of cool it down, bring the two together, and I think you'll have better luck.
Ah, good idea.
Sounds good.
Drive safely,
okay,
Eric.
Thank you.
Sounds
Thanks
delicious.
A lot.
Take
we
care.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Sarah in Beckett, Mass. Sarah, you're on. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I tried to make a starter. I had read a recipe using water and raisins. And after about 4 days, there was, I thought, a little mold. And it had said to use the starter after bubbles formed. At that point, I added it to flour. It never took off. It didn't become the starter or the dough that I had expected. Have you had any experience with, this was a raisin starter. The same cookbook had recipe for citrus starter and also for a yam starter, all done the same way.
All right. Well, Sarah, that's a great question. So when you're saying starter, I assume you're trying to essentially create a yeast ferment that you would then use to make a bread.
Right.
Okay. Well, when we sort of look at the system that you have there, And I like to talk about food as a system instead of a recipe. Mm-hmm. I use the word formula instead of recipe,
okay.
Just because we've got to be precise. When I think about a starter, what do we have there? We have some warm water, and we have your yeast, and we have your raisins. And essentially what the raisins are there for, they're essentially just sugar. So they're
right.
providing an energy source for the yeast to grow. So were you able to get fermentation? Were you able to get sort of the creation of sort of that frothy sort of yeast? You were able to get that with the raisins or not?
Probably not.
Okay. I'm wondering, did you just drop the raisins in straight or did you sort of pulverize them?
Oh, no. They were left whole.
Okay. I would think that one of the things you may want to consider doing is sort of maybe even sort of if you have a mortar and pestle, sort of grinding them up in the mortar and pestle. Just make you want to disperse that sugar throughout the starter as much as you can because the yeast, you know, yeast are great little sort of fungi, but they don't have feet and they don't have legs. So they can't walk to where they need to go. They may have flagella, but they can't really sort of move that far. So if we have sugar everywhere, I think you'll have a better chance at sort of creating a vibrant microbial culture there that will then allow you to use that to ferment your bread dough.
Okay. Thank you for your advice.
Very good. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. 1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop, and it's a Food Friday / Science Forum here. We're joined by Ted Russin of the Culinary Institute of America, a research chemist who knows lots of fascinating things about cooking and the science of the whole thing. Artificial flavors.
Okay.
Tell me how somebody in a one of you guys in lab coats mm-hmm. can say, I want to flavor this like a banana, and they can do it.
Okay. Well, lab coats are still cool. I think maybe next time,
very cool.
When we come back, we'll bring you a lab
well,
coat.
Well, you know, I'd love that.
That would be pretty groovy.
That would look great at home. Maybe a fez,
oh,
I think, as well.
A lab coat and a fez, that'd
yeah,
be great.
Yeah, it'd be great at home. Maybe, the kids would be frightened.
Maybe a boa or something. That'd be
sure.
great. So, the flavors, okay, so when we talk about flavor and I'll talk about it as a chemist because flavor is also something that a diner perceives as well. So there's a massive sort of psychological
yeah.
element to flavor. But as a chemical sort of phenomena, we have a range of different materials that provide flavors. They're usually smaller organic molecules. So, and what do I mean by that? When I say something, everybody knows the taste of vinegar. Everybody,
yeah.
some people like it, some people don't. We use it all in our vinaigrettes. A vinaigrette, the main sort of flavor compound that gives you that aroma is acetic acid. It's a very small molecule. It's very volatile. If you were ever to get a very concentrated vinegar, you would walk in, if you left it open, the whole room would smell like it.
Yeah.
So most of flavor compounds are very small molecules like that. And they sort of tickle our nose. They tickle our nose and the receptors in our nose. They're not detected in our tongue so much. They're detected in sort of the olfactory bulb. Because we can only really pick up 5 tastes in the mouth. So we perceive these as flavors. Now, every food compound, like say, for example, if you like the flavor of a strawberry, there are different small molecules in a strawberry, whether they're ketones, aldehydes, small acids, whatever it may be, they are flavor compounds that we know and we could separate and identify. And we can also extract them. So for example, I'm trying to think of a... I'll give you an example. If you've made a vinaigrette, 3 parts oil, 1 part vinegar, you've mixed that up.
Okay.
And eventually it sort of separates into 2 fractions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a phase separation where you basically have an oil phase and a water phase. Well, chemists use those types of physical separations to actually pull flavors out of different foods. So we could theoretically extract the flavor compounds out of a strawberry by using oil or by using a different type of carbon dioxide or something like that. We could pull them out. So we could pick out those flavors essentially extract them from anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is also, I'll be frank with you, that is a very expensive process to do. And while we could do that with absolutely everything, it would be costly. Our food costs would just shoot through the roof. So what we end up doing sort of and I'm not a flavor chemist by background, but as I understand sort of the flavor industry, we essentially use those molecules. We know what they are. We know their shapes. They're in the foods we eat, full stop. Okay? These are not chemicals that are not present in nature. They're there.
Okay.
And we basically create manners and ways, either through fermentation or through chemical synthesis, to make those on a more efficient scale. And then we have our small tinctures that we use.
It must be fairly inexpensive because if you buy food off the shelf, mm-hmm. there's a lot of artificial flavor.
There is. And I liken, I prefer to use the, you know, the term natural flavors are actually essentially based on compounds that we have seen
okay.
in nature. Whereas artificial flavors may have a sense, they may feel like or taste like banana, but we perceive them as banana, but they may not necessarily be found in a banana. But you also can make flavors on your own. You can make tinctures. If you're taking some vanilla beans and steeping them in your vodka, perhaps, it's Friday night, right?
Right.
So you're going to go home and drink your vanilla vodka responsibly. And, you know, you can extract those flavor compounds because some flavors are soluble in alcohol. We can do the same thing with oil. You take your chipotle peppers and you drop them in vegetable oil, and you could eventually pull out those flavors into the oil. So a lot of very similar processes are done. They're just done more efficiently.
Let's go back to the phones. Mary in Saratoga Springs. Mary, you're on.
Oh, hi, Ray. I have a question. First of all, I have to give you a disclaimer. I don't drink, but I love to bake with liqueurs. Okay. Now, I have a great recipe for a pound cake with Chambord, which I've done many times, but most of the time when the cake is ready to be removed from the oven and I slice it after it's cooled down, it seems as if the liquid has condensed into a hard chunk at the bottom of the cake. And I follow all the directions. I've been doing this for 30 years. So I was wondering what I can do. I asked the chef, and he said, reduce the heat and let it cook longer, and that didn't work.
Well, Mary, thank you so much. There's nothing like cooking liquid liqueurs. There's nothing like it.
Yeah.
In fact, again,
right now I'm stirring fresh strawberries with a Chambord.
You know what? That sounds delicious. We should all go over to Mary's place.
Yeah, indeed.
Yes. But Mary, that's a very good question. It actually sort of builds off of Ray's earlier question about extracting flavors. So you're using alcohol. That Chambord is a very, very, you know, pungent and sort of delicious flavor. And you're using that in your layer cake or in your sponge cake.
Right.
The challenge with using alcohol in any kind of baked product is that the alcohol essentially prevents the flour that you're using. You're using cake flour, I assume?
Yes.
Okay, so you're using cake flour. It kind of softens that, the ability of the cake flour to actually make that network, to make that sponge, because the proteins just don't unfold the same way as if there would be water, all completely 100% water in the base. So, you have alcohol. So you add the alcohol when you're making the batter, right? This is not added. You don't just fold this in right at the end.
No, I add the dry ingredients and alternate with the milk and the Chambord.
Okay, so there's a few things that you may want to do. You could potentially change to instead of using cake flour, you may want to move to a all-purpose flour, which will give you more gluten, which will hopefully give you more of a structure. Because essentially, what's happening when you're baking and it's collapsing is that's essentially what's happening. It's collapsing, and the crumb and those little pores are just getting compressed, and you have that bottom layer of liquid that is still delicious, but it just doesn't look very nice.
No, that's right. It doesn't have the texture.
It doesn't have the texture of a cake. You want sponge. We want crumb, right? That's what we're looking for. So that's one thing you could potentially do. The other thing you could potentially do is basically develop your batter. And add your Chambord right at the last second, if you have enough milk there to be able to create your batter. So that will allow your proteins in the cake batter to develop, and then theoretically, hopefully, allow for they will develop as best as they can, and then the Chambord won't prevent that because it's added at the last second and folded in.
Great, I'll try that.
Perhaps.
If it works, I'll mail the cake to Ray.
Fantastic! I win, Mary. Thank you very much.
Hey, listen, do you have a minute for an old recipe?
Sure.
You get a large cantaloupe, fresh, pretty ripe. Make balls, put it in a bowl, mix white rum, orange juice, lemon juice, sugar, stir it all together and let it sit, and invariably company goes wild for it as dessert.
Oh, my God. I'm coming. I am going to your house, Mary. We'll
see you later. It's all Chambord and all kinds of liqueurs.
For someone who doesn't drink.
Yeah, I know. she eats it. She may not drink it.
You're the ultimate host. Hey, Mary, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Okay, thank you. You too.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We're joined by Ted Russin. Today we talk the science of food. Greg in Warwick. Greg, you're up.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Can you hear us okay?
I can.
Then we're all set.
I'm also driving, but and hands-free.
Okay.
I have a cookie question. I think it borders on science and chemistry. You know, I always read where, you know, it says first, you know, beat the butter to get it soft and fluffy, and then add eggs, and then add, you know, I'm sorry, not add the sugar, then add eggs after you beat with the sugar. Can I just put it all in together? It's going to make a really definable difference if I do it that way.
Well, Greg, that's a very, very good question. We all like cookies. Who doesn't like a cookie? Now, this kind of gets down to, and again, as I was saying about the class I teach at the college, it's you know, subtitled, What Have You Done For Me Lately? And when we start thinking about the order of addition of why ingredients come together, they have a certain function, they have a role. So when you're creaming sugar, what you're essentially doing is you're... And this is good. There's a more fundamental principle here. We all like, when we look at a cake, when we bake it, it has all these little bubbles, and we've added baking powder or baking soda to it, or we've added yeast to it that allows it to rise and leaven. What's actually happening is the cake is rising, but there's no new gas that's created. So essentially, if we don't get bubbles into the batter at time zero before it gets into the oven, there's going to be no new bubbles formed. So when you whip your batter, we need to get, basically, we call them seed points for gas expansion. When you're creaming, to make your cookies, when you're trying to basically cream your sugar and your butter, what you're doing there is if you think about it, it's almost like, and I'm going to use a non-edible example, but if you're putting, imagine you use sand and dropped it into butter and sort of stirred it up. The sand would act as it would create resistance.
Yeah.
It would allow for the opening of little pockets, small pockets in the butter, and that's essentially making the little bubbles that are going to help leaven our cookie when it bakes. So when you sort of combine the sugar and the butter together, you're essentially creating a situation where you're getting air into the system. And that's really the only place in your cookie recipe that you'll get air. You might have some leavening. You may have baking powder and baking soda. And again, those gases, when the carbon dioxide is prepared there or produced there, that carbon dioxide only expands in the bubbles that you put in there when you were creaming the sugar and the butter. So really, that's my hypothesis. That's how I understand the system. But if I was you, and I would, you know, I would channel your inner scientist, put on your lab coat, and I would say, make them both ways, and get an informal panel, get all your buddies together and say, let's have a cookie tasting and see which one you prefer, because maybe too much air in a cookie is just not so good because it doesn't concentrate the chocolate chips. Okay, it dilutes them. So that's what I would say. I have a theory, and I think that's the case. But ultimately, I would say just taste them. Do it both ways and taste them.
All right. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Greg, thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. It's a Food Friday. 1-800-348-2551. Back for the lightning round in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from Pangea, North Bennington, Vermont, catering Southern Vermont weddings and corporate events with menus designed for special occasions, VermontFineDining.com and Facebook. Sundog Cider at Sulaqua, locally produced hard cider from New York Hudson Valley apples, unfiltered, naturally gluten-free, handcrafted at a revitalized solar-powered mill in Chatham, New York, SundogCider.com. Hudson Valley Fresh Dairy, a partnership of 9 Hudson Valley dairy farms providing fresh local milk, cream, sour cream, and yogurt to our neighbors, HudsonValleyFresh.com. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre. And Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at Berkshire Health Systems, plastic, reconstructive, and hand surgery at laser skin treatments by Dr. Rodrigo Santa Marina, BerkshireHealthSystems.org/plastics.
Fox Pop on WAMC. It's a Food Friday and a most interesting one. Ted Russin is Director of Consulting at the Culinary Institute of America. He is a research chemist, and we have learned quite a bit about why food tastes the way it does, cooks the way it does. And we go back to the phones, and David in Greenfield. David, you're on.
Hi, I'm a 53-year-old male, and I guess I suffer from ketosis. I'm wondering why there is all these food fads that basically use different chemistry to help the body lose weight. Isn't there a correct way? That's basically my question.
Well, David, thank you for the question. And that's I will sort of preface this with the fact that I'm not a dietitian, nor am I a medical doctor. However, I am a chemist, and I think about food, and we deal with calories all the time. One of the challenges that we deal with in CIA Consulting is making foods healthier for people. In addition to that, in our program, we just had an assignment in our class when we were looking to cut down the calories and the sodium in hamburgers, and we ended up using mushrooms to do that at different ratios. So that the challenge of calories in principle is where it's at. And I think that, you know, I'm not a psychologist either, but I do think certainly people struggle a lot with their weight and struggle a lot with sort of food as something that we have to do every three meals. And as a chemist, my simple answer is calorie is in versus calories out is where it's at. And it's a contained, your body is a contained system that burns energy. And if we have too much energy, then we eventually decide, much like our ancestors decided to store this around just in case all the food dries up and we end up in a drought. But it often is not as simple as that. I know people have challenges controlling their calories. People, at a more fundamental level, people may not even know the caloric density of the food they're eating. So I think from a sort of a more fundamental level, I think it's like I say, calories in, calories out is a simple answer. But I do think the way foods are presented to us, even in a restaurant, we don't even, you know, at least in the retail space, you have a nutrition panel that will allow you to understand the carbohydrate breakdown. Because you'll see carbs and it'll say simple sugars and it will say fiber. So you have some insight on that. However, when you start going out for a meal, it's a whole other story. And often I know there's been literature been showed that the caloric density of foods out there in sort of the food service world is higher. And we have more control over it at home. So I think it is a very challenging problem, and I don't think there's an easy solution. I think ultimately all these books are aiming at the same thing, to try to create a healthy lifestyle. So at the crux of that is the food you're eating as well as the activity that you have.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
1-800-348-2551 is the number on this Food Friday. And let's go to Mark in Petersburg, New York. Mark, you're on.
Hi, I would like information on the best way to cook grass-fed beef. The way I normally cook, say, a rib steak is I do it in a water bath at the high 120s for 2 hours, and then I drop it down to maybe 120 for an hour before I finish it on the grill. When I try this with grass-fed beef, it still comes out fairly tough.
That's a good question, Mark. So are you using actually sous vide equipment? Are you using a water bath and using a vacuum sealer?
Yeah, I'm using a vacuum seal and immersion circulator.
I'm very pleased to hear that this equipment is becoming, it's out there, and that's great. Because I think that, and I love that you have that precision with temperature. We'll convert you to use Celsius at some point. That's a good question. I think that at the crux of it, Mark, is the fact that the grass-fed beef is just so lean. That's really where it's at. When we start thinking about the role that fat plays in any kind of food product, is it essentially softens things up. So if we were to make, for example, I'm not sure if you're a custard enthusiast, but if you were to make a custard, say, you know, egg yolks, sugar, vanilla, and cream, if you were to make that with skim milk, 2% milk, 4% milk, and then half and half and full fat cream, you would see that the texture of that same custard with the same amount of eggs, same amount of sugar, would change. The skim milk would be very brittle and almost chewy, whereas the manufacturing cream or the heavy cream would be very soft. And that we could think about that as an analogy for the grass-fed beef versus sort of corn-fed beef, is that the degree of marbling, its ability to sort of, the manner in which how it is distributed in the piece of meat, I think will impact tremendously the texture. And I think that with regards to your system in particular, I think the challenge is that your meat is just leaner. And if I was, you know, and I'm not a chef, I'll tell you that I don't even pretend to be one. But if we know that we don't have much fat there to basically interrupt the texture of the meat to soften it, we're going to need to compensate for that in terms of cooking temperatures and cooking times. So what I would probably suggest is sort of dropping the time, because as meat cooks, the proteins in there sort of tighten up and essentially squeeze milk. Meat, when I talk about meat in my class, meat is essentially a gel. It's basically water trapped in a protein network. So as meat cooks, that gel contracts and squeezes water out. So that's part of the change in texture that we appreciate when we cook a piece of meat. So if you don't have the fat there and the meat is going to basically condense and squeeze out water, maybe you want to be a little more gentle with your heating. So maybe you're going
more
to...
rare?
Yeah, exactly. Cut down on your cooking temperature and cooking time. So I think those two things would help out in terms of preserving the moistness and the richness of your meat. I think searing it at the end is great because that will allow you to still get those nice brown flavors on the surface of the meat, and that won't really cause too much changes to the internal temperature of the meat itself.
So you would move more to the low 120s,
yeah,
and maybe an hour?
Yes, exactly. I would try that, and again, as a good scientist, put on your lab coat, and we'll sort of, you could try a few different temperatures and time combinations, because ultimately cooking is essentially a combination of temperature and time. But I would definitely first and foremost start dropping the temperature.
Well, great. I very much appreciate it. And added fat to the bag isn't going to have any effect,
not,
right?
You know, really, it will... I think it'll help you get a richer
adding
perception.
Adding what to the bag?
Fat. So say, for example, you put butter into the actual bag, you vacuum seal that, you drop it in your water bag.
Yeah.
So it's essentially cooking in a fat. That will give you richness. That will, I'll be frank with you, it will give you surface moistness. But unless you're sort of forcing that fat into the meat, and you would need a very strong vacuum to do that, and even then it may penetrate maybe half an inch to a quarter of an inch, you won't be able
right.
to get to that center of your meat with, unless, the other flip side is you could, if you wanted to, you could lard your meat. Essentially use sort of a larding needle to actually add butter and sort of marble the meat yourself.
Well, why
fat.
Wouldn't you just buy meat that's not so lean then, if
well,
you're going to go to that trouble?
Well, that's a question. But, you know, if grass-fed beef does have a certain flavor to it too that's very unique and very different. So there's many ways to sort of cook this steak, if you like, for lack of a better pun.
Mark.
Well, thank you very much. I very much appreciate it.
Mark, when you do your experiments, take some notes, and the next time Ted is on the program, maybe a few months from now, let us know how you did, okay?
Okay, great.
Sounds Thanks. Great. Bon appetit.
Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Ted Russin is Director of Consulting at the Culinary Institute of America, a research chemist. Now, you taught a massive online course for Harvard. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I taught a portion of that class. A class, edX is this online MOOCs, they call them massive open online courses.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a range of different MOOCs that Harvard and Cornell and Stanford run as an outreach to basically anybody could sign up for these classes. There was one class, they actually have a cooking and science class at Harvard University for the undergraduate students that are there. So mm-hmm. it's a science-based class. It's not necessarily a class that's in the chemistry department. It's a class that's open to essentially everybody, undergraduate liberal arts and science students. And this class, this edX class, grew out of that. So 2 years ago, I was invited, and I have a chef that I collaborate with quite frequently. He's a good friend, Chef Wiley Dufresne, down in New York City. WD50 is his restaurant, his sort of flagship restaurant. He also has Alder Restaurant in the Lower East Side. If you're there, go. It's delicious. But we've worked together for years. You know, we worked on sort of making foams that have a texture of shaving cream. So instead of having a whipped cream texture
or a meringue texture,
just because, well, you know.
Just to do it? Just to prove you can do it?
If you look at shaving cream, it has a different sort of pore size, and the bubbles are a different size, and the way you feel it in your hands, like, I've never eaten shaving cream.
No. Good for you.
But maybe you have. Well, I don't know if you're, you have the good taste.
Sloppy shaver.
Yeah, yeah.
It happens once in a while, I suppose.
I use an electric shaver. But anyways.
There you go.
That texture is just so unique, and it's so different. And imagine that even on a biscuit. It would be a very different experience than a frosting or a meringue.
Yeah.
So it's these types of things that chefs are exploring. So we've been collaborating for years. I co-taught a lecture with him in that undergraduate class, and
mm-hmm.
then we were invited as chef and scientist to do a larger sort of 10 video clips for this massive online open course, where we talked about the use of enzymes, which are sort of very specific proteins that can do specific things in food systems, to talk about enzymes in the kitchen and how they work. So it was but in that class, we have some of the greatest living chefs. David Chang is in that class teaching courses, Jose Andres, Nathan Myhrvold, who is the publisher or the author of Modernist Cuisine. So you have these superstars in the culinary world. Some of them graduates from the Culinary Institute of America
mm-hmm.
that have come, are doing this sort of larger sort of service to the broader public.
1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones. Who's calling?
I guess I'm on.
You're on.
Judy.
Hi, Judy. You're on.
Hello. My question is, how do I get a smooth glaze on creme brulee?
Smooth glaze on creme brulee.
I'm either firing it wrong or I'm using the wrong mixture on the top because
okay.
what I'm getting are a bunch of bubbles.
Okay. So, Judy, it's a pleasure to chat with you. It's always nice to chat about creme brulee.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is what you're doing when you're sort of, and by glaze you mean that sugar, that crispy sugar coat on the
exactly.
on the surface of it, and that's the beauty of a creme brulee, is to smash through that crispy coat into this creamy, unctuous sort of custard.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is essentially there isn't much you can really do in terms of the ingredients that you have at your avail. It's essentially just caramelized sugar.
Right.
And they're really, I wouldn't suggest cutting it with anything. I wouldn't suggest cutting it or using icing sugar or anything like that. It's the small crystalline, sort of pure crystal sugar that you would use. You may want to grind it to a smaller particle size. You could theoretically do that. So I don't know if you have a food processor. You could actually make a finer grind of sugar, because essentially what you're trying to do is combust the sugar. You're essentially trying to burn it. So the more the surface area, the faster it will burn. So theoretically, you could get a more efficient and effective burn or a combustion of that sugar if the particle size is smaller. Now, the other thing, too, is I assume, are you using a broiler or using a blowtorch, or how are you doing that?
I'm using a culinary torch, yes.
Yes, a culinary torch. I would suggest that definitely as opposed to a broiler, because in a broiler, you're just warming up the whole bloody custard.
Right.
So you don't want that, because then although warm custard is pretty good, too, I'll tell you that. So essentially, you know, it's you want to do it fast, you want to do it quick, and perhaps a smaller grind size on the sugar would help, but don't use something like icing sugar. There's no oxygen present around the crystals to actually sort of combust. So those are the two things I would consider. The other thing you can do, and I know this is not a traditional culinary technique, but you could theoretically make a caramel in a pot. So essentially take sugar, brown it, and then basically pour it on top of your custard.
Okay.
And then just sort of, but you're gonna have to work fast, because it's, and you got to be careful you don't burn your sugar. But you could basically sort of warm it, a little bit of water, sugar, stir that, get that to the point where it's brown and bubbly, and then just pour it on top, and it'll make a clear sheen glass on top of that.
Yeah, go to a restaurant and it has a nice clean sheen, clear sheen, and mine has bubbles.
So that perhaps they're doing it that way. But the other thing you have to be aware of is be careful with how much sugar you put on top, because you could essentially make a quarter inch sort of glass or sugar glass on top of that, which still is delicious, but that it will kind of impact the ability to get to the custard.
Okay, so I should maybe even try a mortar and pestle, which I do have to grind
down
the sugar a
little
bit.
Try that with a torch, and or try sort of making a caramel or a burnt sugar, essentially toasted sugar, solution that you pour on top of your custard.
Sounds like a plan.
Thank you. Bon appetit.
Thanks a lot. Let's go to Susie in Jefferson, New York. Hi, Susie, you're on.
Hi.
Good day, Susie.
Hello. Do you want to say anything? You want to say anything?
Yes, I have a question about strawberry jam.
Ooh, delicious. Perfect time of year.
Yes, I would like to make strawberry jam, but I would like to use a pressure canner because it's more efficient and it uses less water.
Okay.
But I can't find a recipe for it, and I want to make sure it's not going to break down the pectin that it's safe to use.
Okay, well I've made jam in my day. It's always delicious, and it's a way to preserve the bounty of the season. The challenge is, of course, the pectin. You mentioned pectin, so jam is essentially sugar, fruit, and pectin. And pectin is a small sugar that's found in fruit that actually gives the structure and the shape to every piece of fruit that we've ever eaten. It's also found in vegetables. So we use that pectin to essentially, we break down the fruit, add sugar to it, add a bit of acid, and then the pectin sets that and turns it into a gel. Now, with regards to pressure cooking it or pressure heating it, pectin itself is a very, very robust ingredient. If you pressure cook it, you won't cause any problems. You won't break down your pectin. That won't happen at all. It will be very robust. So that's one thing you don't have to worry about. With regards to actually doing a pressure cooking, so you would make your jam, you would prepare it hot, you'd pour it into your containers, and then you take your containers and put it in your pressure cooker. Is that what you're planning to do?
Yeah, in the pressure canner.
Okay. I've never used a pressure canner, so I won't speak to it. However, you know, be safe. It's a pressurized vessel, so you don't want that to sort of explode on you. But be very safe with it. But it will be that those high temperatures will help preserve the acid, the sugar, and the high temperatures will help preserve. So when you're in January eating your jam, you're laughing all the way to the delicious, all the way at your plate, because you have that bounty of the season.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susie. We appreciate it. And the number to call, we only have about a minute left, so I hesitate to take another call, but we could do it if our call screener gives it to us. Otherwise, Jeff Levine, if somebody's interested in finding out more about the Culinary Institute, how do they do that?
The website is ciachef.edu, and we do have a new bachelor's degree in culinary science that is junior and senior year after students take get their associate degree in either culinary arts or baking pastry arts. And Ted is one of the professors teaching that class. And each of the classes has both a scientist and a chef.
Oh, nice.
In the culinary science program, which is great.
Yeah, it is quite a novel approach to sort of teaching people about both the art and science, as you mentioned, the art and science of food. We do it every day. And the chef today, Chef Louis and I were tasting different chef creations, different student creations of veal. Mm. And we had this, the culinary story saying, I would do this with flavor. And then there's the technical story saying, well, did you cook it this way? What temperature do you use? Why did you do that? Maybe you want to use this other ingredient to pull out some more of these other flavors. So it's a very unique sort of almost... I don't want to say bipolar, but I want to say sort of a sort of bimodal world where we kind of get two voices at the same plate.
Ted Russin, this has been a fascinating hour, and I hope you come back again soon. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks to everybody who called in and everybody for listening. Support comes from Gigi Trattoria in Rhinebeck, Hudson Valley, Mediterranean since 2001, expanding their farm-to-table catering with their easy, entertaining seasonal menus online for small, impromptu, or large gatherings. GigiHudsonValley.com. Barry Price Architecture since 1996, specializing in buildings that integrate modernism and sustainability with regional materials and aesthetics. BarryPriceArchitecture.com. The Meat Market, Great Barrington, Nose to Tail Butcher Shop and Cafe, Summer Sausage Fest, June 28th, noon to 9 p.m., featuring 12 types of sausage grilled over wood fire. TheMeatMarketGB.com. And National Museum of Dance, Saratoga Springs, New York, dedicated to dance through exhibits, tours, programming, dance classes, and more. DanceMuseum.org. Thanks again for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered by Mike Allinger. I'm Ray Graff. Join us on Monday. Alan will be back for a Medical Monday. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Stay tuned now for a news update.